Thanks, Claire, and thank you to the organisers for inviting me to speak. And I'm sure you're aware it's a very exciting and dynamic time in viral hepatitis at the moment, so I'm going to try and take you through what I see as some of the good points and some of the not-so-good challenges that we're facing. These are my disclosures, but also I just want to disclose that I am going to be talking very much about data from the Australian setting today. I know this is a regional conference, and that's not to ignore people who are not from Australia, but Australia really is leading the way in some of these initiatives in viral hepatitis, and I think globally we can learn a lot from what's happening within the Australian setting, so I hope there's interest for everybody. So most of you will be aware that in 2016, for the first time, the WHO set viral hepatitis elimination targets to be achieved by 2030. So these are very ambitious targets, but they do give governments and countries a framework to work towards, and they include a mortality reduction of 65% and a 90% reduction in incidence or new cases. And that relates to actually a 95% reduction in hepatitis B and an 80% decline in hepatitis C to be aimed for. There are also targets relating to treatment, so 80% of eligible treatments should be on treatment, and 90% of treated hepatitis C patients should be cured. Now, just turning to hepatitis C first, so Australia certainly is on track so far, so we're only a few years out from those targets, and you can see there's actually 12 countries that are currently on track in green, Australia being one of those countries still aiming to get to those targets. And one of the reasons why Australia is in green there is because Australia was one of the first countries to have a really a very broad program of universal access funded by the government for the DAA therapies, which you will know are very highly effective, easily taken therapies, and the Australian government put these on the PBS access for all patients living with hepatitis C in Australia in 2016, and you can see the amazing uptake of treatment that happened after that. And in fact, now we estimate that around 75,000 people living with hepatitis C in Australia have been treated, and that's around a third of our chronic hepatitis C population. So that's an amazing achievement over just three or four short years. And another really encouraging aspect of the Australian response has been the encouragement of prescribing outside of the specialist sphere. So, probably encouraged by the S100 HIV experience, very quickly Australia took to a model whereby non-specialists could prescribe DAA therapy, and we now see that around 70% of DAA prescriptions are written by non-specialists, so GPs in the dark green and other non-specialist physicians there. And I think this is really critical to achieve those elimination targets, and other countries have taken a while to really come on board with this, but I think it's starting to happen globally. And in fact, if you look at GP DAA prescribing, now we see that around 17% of GPs in Australia have prescribed a course of DAA therapy. That varies slightly across jurisdiction, clearly slightly higher in Queensland and WA, where there may be more rural prescribing and more need for GPs to take on prescribing. But I think this is really encouraging data, one in five GPs having now prescribed hepatitis C compared to where we were a few years ago. Other encouraging data is on the outcomes of DAA treatment across all patient groups and all service types. So REACH-C is a study we run from the Kirby. It's looking at outcomes, and it's now up to 10,000. We're looking at outcomes in 10,000 patients prescribed DAAs across a range of service types in Australia. And here you can see, now this is a per protocol analysis because in fact, around 20% of patients, we don't know what their outcome is, and that's one of the challenges we face. That's patients who just haven't turned back up for their SVR despite attempts to chase them down. But in the people that we do know the outcome of, you can see that a DAA therapy, whatever DAA therapy is used, is highly effective, 96% of people achieving cure, and that is the same across many different patient types, including HIV status, people who are recently injecting, people on OST. There is a slight drop-off in people who are cirrhotic, you might expect that, but very encouraging data for a universal rollout program. And if you look at that data, again, by service model type, I think this is really important because REACH-C is across many different service types. And there you can see that the outcomes are the same, whether you're in a specialist liver clinic, GP, sexual health practice, drug and alcohol, et cetera, mental health service. So clearly, there doesn't need to be any containment of prescribing within specialist services any longer. So just to think, how are we actually doing? Because if you're going to hit those targets, you really need to address, firstly, in terms of incidence or new infections, you need to address the high-risk transmission populations. And those really are people who inject drugs. They're also prisoners. And to a lesser extent, but certainly something very relevant to this conference, what we've recognized is the epidemics of sexually transmitted hepatitis C going on in the HIV-positive MSM population. So we need to look at these populations to see whether we're actually achieving anything with the this rollout. So this is some really important data just coming out recently from Lisa Mara and Jenny Iverson at Kirby, who run the annual needle syringe program survey, which surveys between 2,000 to 2,500 injectors every year. And takes a dry blood spot from them as well. So here you can see on the left in the red, the proportion of those people attending needle and syringe programs who say they have had treatment for hepatitis C, rising from only 11% in 2016-15 up to over 50% in 2018. So that's an incredible evidence that the treatment is happening in the right populations. And correspondingly, the RNA prevalence has dropped by over half, from 51% to just 20% in these people. So I think this is great data. And if you just look at that a little bit more broken down, you can see that, in fact, it looks like both men and women are taking up treatment equally. So prevalence was actually a bit higher in men, but now it's equal, 20% in both genders. If you look at it by age, again, prevalence was higher by age group, so the older you were, you're more likely you were to be RNA positive, but treatment had been across the board, and now we see prevalence sitting at about 20% across all age groups, so we're getting to the older populations, the populations that really need to be treated for mortality targets. Here we see the data again looking about at people who have been incarcerated in the last 12 months, and you can see that RNA prevalence was higher in those who had been in prison back in 2015, about 10% higher, but now sitting again around 20% whether or not you have been incarcerated. And in fact, the programs of DA rollout in prison have been also one of the great success stories, and there have been some really effective programs that are going on in prisons. Prison prescribing in New South Wales now makes up 25% of all DAA scripts being written. And so this is key to get to these really populations needing to be treated. Maybe some slightly less encouraging data by Indigenous status. So in 2015, 50% prevalence of RNA in Indigenous and non-Indigenous groups. And unfortunately, it looks like the Indigenous population may be falling a little bit behind. Treatment uptake may not be so great within that population, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Just turning to the co-infected population, another high-risk population. This is data from the CEASE study, which is a cohort looking at co-infected individuals and what's happened to them over the rollout of DAA therapy. And you can see there that now we see in this population 91% of people who had hepatitis C have now been treated. And that's irrespective of what risk group you come from, whether you're an injector or whether you're a high-risk sort of sexual transmission population. And as a result of achieving those very, very high treatment uptake numbers, what we see in terms of prevalence is that RNA prevalence in that cohort, which was sitting at about 80% in 2014, so 20% had already been treated or cleared, is now down at just 9%. And this is really an astonishing reduction in RNA prevalence in the HIV-positive group. And I think in the CEASE cohort, because we've achieved that really significant reduction in prevalence, our reinfection incidence is now sitting at less than 1%. And if you're aware of some of the data from Europe that suggests that their reinfection incidence is around 10 to 13% in their HIV-positive populations, I think you can see what we've managed to achieve here with really that very rapid and high uptake of treatment in our populations. And I just want to acknowledge, I know there's some CEASE authors in the audience here that that manuscript has just been accepted by CID today. So I'm very happy about that. That's coming out soon. What about at the other end of those mortality targets? So not the incidence, but the mortality. So to address mortality, you really have to be demonstrating that you're having an effect on end-stage liver disease and liver-related deaths. And this, again, is some really encouraging data coming out from the New South Wales Data Linkage Project, led by Mariam Alavi from our program and others. And what this shows is that looking at the data linkage, the observed deaths that we're now seeing is very much on track with what we predicted would happen. So you can see the inflection points at around 2015-16 for decompensated cirrhosis, HCC, and liver-related deaths, showing that we are beginning to have an impact on mortality through the DAA rollout. So that's all the good news, but clearly there are a lot of challenges. And one of the challenges, and this is a global challenge, is that DAA initiations are falling off. The number of patients we're treating every month is reducing. Now, clearly there was a lot of warehousing of patients back in the early days. We're sitting at about 13 to 14,000 a year at the moment. Modeling by Amy Kwan there in the top graph, you can see we are still in the blue line, just on track to meet some of those treatment targets. But if we fall off any lower, if we start to drop below the 10,000 a year mark, we are going to fall off track with hitting our target. So this is a real challenge about how we keep the number of initiations going per month that we need to continue to reach the numbers. Now, I don't know if I really like this analogy, but it's something that's used and talked about quite a lot, this idea of low-hanging fruit, high-hanging fruit in terms of populations. I think it does serve a purpose, though, when we think about it, because it's true that the HIV-positive populations I've talked about, people with cirrhosis, people on OST, and even prisoners to some extent, these are all people who are engaged in care. They're already linked into health services. They're already linked into practitioners. And so they are the easiest people to reach with the message of easy Hep C treatment. So in some ways, these have been the low-hanging fruit. And I think we have to challenge ourselves and think about how to get to the more difficult to reach populations. And as I said, that might be some evidence that the indigenous population, we need to think a little bit more innovatively about how we reach that population in terms of Hep C therapy. People who inject drugs, who are disengaged, who don't go to needle and syringe programs. These are the people that we see in hospital come in maybe with injecting-related endocarditis, cellulitis, and they go out. And that's their only point of interaction with healthcare services. People are in mental health, long-term mental health institutions who at the moment can't be treated. So these are the kind of focus where we need to change our address into the future. There are quite a number of model of care projects underway in Australia at the moment. This is just a few of them. Scale C, led by James Ward at SAMRI and with help from Marianne Martineau from Kirby, who's leading that as well. That's in the indigenous setting. Look at test and treat for hepatitis C in those communities. The SMILE-C trial, led by Mark Boyd from Adelaide, looking at outcomes in mental health patients. And TOPIC, which is a study I lead, which is looking at inpatient initiation whilst people are in hospital for endocarditis, for example, to try and get them engaged with healthcare services. But there are many, many more models of care underway. And if any of you were at the Elimination Conference, you would see, I think one of the great things to come out of the Hep C drive has been when you give people the tools with the medications and the ability to prescribe and the freedom, you will find that people will innovate and they will find ways of thinking outside the box about how to deliver care in different settings, in different services. And it's really been very encouraging and uplifting to see what's happening across Australia, rolling out and trying to get to these populations. There is another group that really doesn't identify with any of those target populations, if you like, and for want of a better word, I'll call them the others. And these are people who have had a hepatitis C diagnosis but are living in the community, really, as I said, don't identify as being part of a particular group. And there's been quite a lot of discussion about how to reach this very large population that is living with hepatitis C and engage them in care. And I think it's interesting, if you look at the GP prescribing data, you'll see that most GPs have written just one prescription. These are not high caseload GPs who are writing and seeing lots of patients. They've written just maybe one or two prescriptions, and it shows just how thinly spread out in the community these patients may be. And that's a challenge in itself. So how do we reach the others? I don't think we have the answer. There's a number of things being talked about at the moment, again, on a global level. One is universal testing. This has been advocated in the US. I don't think it's going to be cost-effective or practical in Australia, but it is being discussed. What about look-back campaigns? So most people in Australia actually have been diagnosed with the hepatitis C. They have had a diagnosis, around 80%. So it's not a matter of making necessarily so much the new diagnoses, but engaging those people who've had a diagnosis in care. And look-back campaigns may be a way to do that. Increasing, obviously, GP awareness campaigns, the other 80% of GPs who haven't written a script. If all those GPs have just one or two patients maybe in their practice, we really need to try and engage them in hep C prescribing or referral through to a sort of a super GP centre maybe. And then what about community awareness campaigns? And there are community awareness going on campaigns going on at the moment to try and knowledge people in the community, and they may have some effect. I have to leave hepatitis C with this picture. This is where I live at the end of my street in Clovelly in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, which is a very white, affluent area. And I think this is rather ironic because you have the Hep C poster on the phone box there, but right next to the vintage Cellars sign. And I think alcohol in the population where I live is probably far more of a bigger problem, and we shouldn't forget it's a cofactor. So I'm going to leave hepatitis C there and with some of those challenges to think about. What about hepatitis B? Now, is hepatitis B a different challenge? Is it the same challenge? What can we learn from hepatitis C? Do we look at it the same way? I think the first thing to note with hepatitis B is that we have really cheap, effective prevention for hepatitis B in the terms of vaccination. We don't have that for hepatitis C. And so this is really important. And I think there's some really good data. So the Western Pacific region actually is leading the world in terms of what they're achieving with the rollout of birth dose vaccination. So the three doses and the timely within 24 hours first dose, you can see there in the graph on the left, reaching 80-90% since these policies have come into place. And this is going to have a massive effect on obviously prevalence of hepatitis B as this rolls through in the decades to come. And you can see on the graph on the right the effect this is starting to have on the estimated prevalence of chronic hepatitis B in Australia. This is data from the Doherty Institute. Those bottom two lines representing the under fives and the fours to 19s, I think, the younger populations, you can see now the prevalence starting to decline in those groups. And that's mainly because of the vaccination policies overseas, because this is migrant driven. And so we're starting to see the effect of those. And even from within Australia as well, I think this is really nice data. This is just hepatitis B notifications of women giving birth for the first time in New South Wales. And you can see there, I just want to look you to look at the blue line, which represents Australian-born Indigenous women giving birth, and that shows an 80% reduction in hepatitis B notifications through universal testing of women after the targeted vaccination campaigns that rolled out in the late 90s. So this is going to have a real important effect moving forwards. We also have very cheap, effective therapy for hepatitis B. So I'm sure you'd all be aware that tenofovir and entecavir, two drugs, very, very effective, very easy to take, achieve viral suppression in the majority of patients after 3 years and continued into the long term. There is a problem with these therapies, and this has been something we've been aware of for a while, is that whilst they can achieve long-term viral suppression, they don't really achieve S antigen loss, which is the functional cure that we look for in hepatitis B. That only happens in a few percent of people. But there is a massive development pipeline coming down the track for hepatitis B cure. So there are two ways to look at cure. One is to reduce the viral burden. And similar to HIV, there are various ways that the life cycle can be interrupted. So we have the nucleotide agents at the moment. But now on clinicaltrials.gov, I think there is around 32, 33, maybe phase one, two studies of new agents interrupting the viral life cycle. There are many capsid modulators, inhibitors. These drugs are, some of these drugs are moving forward into phase phase three studies soon. They're all phase two or one at the moment. There are siRNA molecules. There are transcription inhibitors. There are entry inhibitors and things that interfere with S antigen synthesis. And so there's a massive pipeline coming through for hepatitis B, not only in terms of some gene editing drugs as well. Not only in terms of reducing viral replication, but also for hepatitis B, activating host immunity is going to be very important. So we have some TLR agonists, toll-like receptor agonists, some PD-1 blockers, and some other drugs, their therapeutic vaccines, etc., which are all going to be important. And I think we don't yet understand how these are all going to be put together to achieve cure, but it's going to be some combination, probably, of drugs that are going to inhibit replication, reduce antigen burden, and also stimulate the immune system. And I think we've got a real challenge to understand how we're going to use these drugs, but it's a great opportunity as well. There are also new ways of measuring cure. So I think up till now we thought about hepatitis B treatment and success of treatment in a very sort of pedestrian way in some ways. These are very broad biomarkers. I think moving forward, we're learning a lot more about other markers. So RNA as a better marker of what's happening within the cell, core antigen levels, quantitative S decline, measures of triple C DNA within the cell. These are going to become important biomarkers of cure and success as we go forward. And I think we're going to need to think about what we mean by cure. So loss of surface antigen, what's called functional cure at the moment, but really the true cure, the loss of triple C DNA and even the loss of integrated hepatitis B DNA is the sterilizing cure. And which of these do we aim for and which is important? And we have to work this out. And I think we also have to think while we're doing that, what do patients want and what's important to patients and for them to be to achieve? So we have to take the patient voice with us while we try and sort out what's happening. So there are some really good things happening in hepatitis B. There are some real problems as well. So this is the hepatitis B care cascade in Australia, again from the Doherty, the mapping report. This is actually 2017, this data. There are around 200,000 people living with hepatitis B at the moment in Australia. Around a third of those are undiagnosed, and around three quarters are not in care for hepatitis B. So they haven't had a viral load monitoring test or on therapy. Of the treatment target, which is only 20%, so not everybody with current treatments has to be on treatment, the treatment target is 20% and less than half of those are receiving treatment. So there are massive gaps in what we're doing already with hepatitis B that really need to be addressed going forward. And these are the Australia 2022 targets in terms of diagnosis, care, and linkage to treatment. And you can see there is progress, but it's incremental progress that is being made. And we need to do much better to really increase the number of people who are in care and on target, on treatment for hepatitis B, even with the drugs we have at the moment. There are also real problems with inequities in access to care. And I think, I know this is a lot of information, it's small, but you can go to the Viral Hepatitis Mapping Project on the ASHAM website and you can put in your primary health network. And this is showing the data by primary health networks across the country. In that first column there is the prevalence in a particular primary health network, PHN. And so you can see at the top, unsurprisingly, is the Northern Territory, followed by behind by Southwest Sydney and Central and Eastern Sydney and down then to the bottom. In the next two columns are the proportion of people who are linked into care, and the third column is on treatment. So here you can see for Central and Eastern Sydney, Southwestern Sydney is actually doing quite well. They've got a reasonably high prevalence, one of the highest prevalence, but the proportion who are on treatment, the last column is reaching 17%. That's almost up at the 20% mark, which is the target. So in fact, with the high prevalence, they're actually getting a lot of patients onto treatment. Unfortunately, and this is mainly due to issues around equities of access to care, you can see it if you look at some areas, such as some areas in Queensland and Western Australia, where it's much more difficult, there's much more rural, remote prescriber settings. Unfortunately, although the prevalence is still high, the proportion of patients on treatment of those eligible is only around 1 to 2%. So these are some real inequities that have to be addressed while we continue to address the other issues that are more encouraging. There are also many different barriers that exist for people living with hepatitis B as compared to those living with HIV or even hepatitis C. The majority of people living with hepatitis B in Australia today are from the cold communities, so around 60% from North and Southern Asia, and they have very different issues in terms of stigma and discrimination that we have to be aware of. And similarly, within the Australian-born setting, the Indigenous population bearing the brunt of chronic hepatitis B, and even within that population, differences in prevalence and diversity that we need to address. So finally, I think one of the challenges for hepatitis B, there are many questions that also remain unanswered. And if you're familiar at all with what's going on in hepatitis B world, there's a big debate about the moment about should we be treating all patients with hepatitis B? Should we just say you've got virus, you should be on therapy? Is this the way we're going to move into the future? And if so, how do we do that? When should treatment be started? How long will treatment duration need to be? How are we going to measure cure? Is there going to be an effect on HCC reduction, which is really the endpoint, and what is the cost effectiveness of cure in these settings? And I think these questions, which are going to become really important in hepatitis B, are both challenges, and they're also opportunities for us to understand and get better at what we're doing. So this is my last slide, really just to say, in summary, I think for both hepatitis C and hepatitis B, we've come a really long way. There are so many really encouraging things in terms of therapeutics, especially. I haven't talked much about point-of-care tests, but there's some really important work going on in developing point-of-care tests to make access to treatment easier and simpler. There are innovative biomarkers to understand better what we're doing, and there's some fascinating work going on in terms of models of care and different forms of service delivery, which really need to happen if we're going to hit those targets. The challenges for hepatitis C is really around what the World Hepatitis Alliance terms reaching the missing millions. In other words, reaching all those people who haven't yet come forward for access to treatment, even though treatment is available, and understanding why not. And for hepatitis B, it's really around understanding cure and what means, and then delivering it. So I'm going to finish there. Just to acknowledge many, many people. These are just a few of my colleagues who provided me with some slides for my talk. Thank you.